Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. WBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and joining us today is an old friend of mine, Marjorie Murray. Marjorie is the founder and president of the California Center for Homeowner Association Law, and they have a fabulous website, and we'll get the web address from Marjorie in a little bit. And Marjorie's been doing some phenomenal stuff in Northern California. Marjorie, I know that you're busy, 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 but thank you so much for taking time out to join us today.
You're very welcome, Sue. I'm always happy to talk about the work that we're doing and to give you updates on our work.
The floor is yours, my friend. Tell us what you've been up to. I know you've been very busy and hard to reach and impossible to reach, in fact.
Well, thank you for your patience and your understanding. We have been occupied in the last year in doing foreclosure defense workshops, not just in Northern California, but in Southern California as well. And these workshops featured consumer attorneys versed in the foreclosures as they play out in common interest development, also known as homeowner associations. These are consumer attorneys who know the procedures and the operations of the debt collectors hired by homeowner associations. So the purpose was twofold. One was to educate homeowners about their consumer rights when it comes to assessment debt collection and foreclosure activity. And then the other was to educate public interest and private bar pro bono attorneys in this area of the law so that there would be more attorneys available to defend homeowners against improperly levied assessments as well as improper debt collector activities under both state and federal fair debt collection laws. So in a nutshell, that's what we were doing. We did 9 workshops. We did them in a number of counties, starting first in Alameda County and then all the way down to San Diego County, which is the southernmost county in the state.
Wow, that's impressive. How many people typically show up at these workshops? And who does them?
The workshops, I think I may have mentioned, were the trainers were consumer attorneys. These are people who have...
So these are actual attorneys who actually do the work, you know, lead the workshops?
Yes.
Awesome.
Right. These are attorneys who are experts in debt collection and foreclosure. And one of the other issues that we looked at was the relationship between foreclosure and discrimination. This has been a longstanding interest and concern of ours that the homeowner association foreclosure seems to be used against seniors, the disabled, and members of ethnic minorities far out of proportion to their numbers in the population. So this is a research topic of interest to us. So two of our workshops looked at the issue of discrimination in homeowner associations. And then as a second framing of that topic, the relationship between discrimination and foreclosure. So among the trainers were consumer attorneys, and we also had experts in fair housing issues. So our goal, as I said, is twofold. It's to educate homeowners about their rights, both fair housing rights, debt collection rights, and also to educate attorneys who are interested in this subject matter area and who may even have clients but want to expand and also deepen their knowledge of this area of the law.
I'm impressed because finding attorneys who are consumer attorneys is extremely difficult. to do. So if you, kudos to you for finding these people who are willing to take the consumer side on this. In California, walk us through the process if you believe you're being discriminated, because I think in California there's a little bit of a twist. Doesn't it have to get approved by an outside, or how does that work? Let's say I lived in Alameda County and I felt that I was being discriminated against for whatever reason, and what do I do?
Well, there's a couple of ways to proceed. In California, we have a state agency, which is called the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing, and it handles fair housing complaints. They are actually charged by the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development to handle fair housing claims in California. So actually there's three ways to go. A complaint could be filed directly with the HUD Civil Rights Division, but the more common, if you will, process is for the homeowner to file a complaint directly with the California Department of Housing, Department of Fair Employment and Housing. In addition to that, and they will process the claim, they will do an analysis, an evaluation, a vetting, if you will, of the claim, determine if there is a bona fide claim, and then move forward from there. The other process that's available is that there are nonprofit housing agencies, fair housing agencies in California, which are directly under contract to HUD's Civil Rights Division.
So they're private organizations.
Yes, they're nonprofits like ours. And I do want to mention that we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization as well. So the homeowner can file with a fair housing agency, which is a private nonprofit. They can file with the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing. They can also file with the HUD Civil Rights Division, although that is the probably the less common way to go, just because that's a larger organization, and the one closer to home in a community is the easier one to work with.
One thing that I found, Marjorie, is that in a lot of states, and I don't know if this is true in California, but in a lot of states, if you go to the government agency, like Human Rights Commission or the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing, or any of these government-sponsored agencies, the question of jurisdiction comes up, and they have dropped the ball time and time and time again in state after state after state. I have heard from people, and they have just said, oh, well, you know, these laws don't apply to homeowner associations, which is pure and utter bunk. What I've been telling people is forget the government agencies and go directly to a private company.
Well, here's how we think about it, Shu, and that is particularly in the environment in which we live now and the environment in California, state agencies are completely overwhelmed. So it is partly, there are two things operating here. They are being asked to do more work with fewer resources and less money. And so just from that, you know, the volume standpoint, it's very difficult. But the other is, and this is what our role is to highlight the relationship between fair housing and homeowner associations. That is, there isn't necessarily a complete understanding by state or local agencies or even by the nonprofits about where the line is to be drawn around a fair housing case in the homeowner association environment. I mean, theoretically, I think state agencies and private nonprofits understand that homeowner associations must comply with fair housing laws. So theoretically, that's understood. What is not understood is how that plays out in a homeowner association.
I've seen it, you know, here, where the industry, where the association attorney will go in and badger the inspector in a government agency, and literally badger the inspector to the point where they drop the case because they say, oh, we're just not, we don't have jurisdiction, we can't go in. And of course then the homeowner becomes fair game for the association, and the attorney of course keeps racking up his fees and being obnoxious and horrible. And I talked to someone in another state, and this was someone who did work for the state government fair housing agency, and I asked her about it, and she said, oh yeah, you know, they do, they'll come in and they'll just beat you about. In fact, they've dropped more cases. They don't want to deal with them because you've got the industry attorneys who are over there saying, hey, you know, you cannot interfere. This is a contract. You're not entitled to interfere. These people agreed to this. Nobody agrees to that.
Well, you are correct about that, and I myself have witnessed that. You may remember my talking on a previous program about the case of Karen Cave, who was a disabled woman up in the California mountains.
We actually had Karen on the show, if you remember.
Well, yes. Oh, I guess I had forgotten that. And in that situation, the problem was that she wanted to be able to exit the subdivision. Now, this is a mountain community which gets, you know, 20 feet of snow a week. I mean, they are buried in snow.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to exit the subdivision, the snow had to be plowed, and the association refused to do it. So she and her family did it. And then the result was that the association fined her, I don't know, it was something like $100 a day, up to the point where the fines reached $50,000. So she did file a complaint with the Department of Fair Employment and Housing. She did get an administrative hearing, and this is how they are handled. Administrative hearing with an administrative law judge. And I attended those hearings, but the homeowner, Karen, as well as the judge, were actually badgered, and I think that is a correct word.
The judge?
Yes. They were badgered by the association attorney. So it was at that point, and in fact, this is one of the things, one of the services that we provide here. We were able to identify a very assertive fair housing attorney to represent Karen, a private attorney to represent Karen in those hearings. And she was able finally to negotiate out a settlement for Karen. But I think that what I've just described only speaks to the issue of there is so much confusion about where the line is to be drawn in a fair housing case, because I did hear the association attorney argue that, first of all, the fair housing laws didn't even apply because
yeah.
this was a private community, it was a
right.
private business.
Right.
Karen agreed to whatever the rules and the future rules were going to be without, and I think at that point it's very important to zero in on the fact that the association may in fact have rulemaking authority, but those rules cannot contravene, let alone break existing law. So rulemaking authority is not absolute.
Well, I mean, even with the rulemaking, they can't strip you of your rights. They can't treat you like dirt.
Well, they can't make up rules that break state and federal laws. I mean, as I said, the rulemaking authority of associations is not absolute. And in fact, in California, this has been one of the important legislative advances by the California legislature that lays out a process for an association to devise rules. There is a set of procedures laid out in statute. So there is a set of procedures, and then there is, in fact, in that statute is a very clear statement that the rules cannot contravene existing law. So the statement is that the rulemaking authority of the association is not absolute.
So what happened to the attorney, the HOA attorney? I mean, he probably went on to do this again and again and again.
Well, it was interesting. It was not the attorney advising the association and retained by the association, but rather it was the attorney for the insurance company.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And, of course, they didn't want to have to pay a large claim. But the settlement was confidential, so I don't know how much money changed hands, but it was a substantial amount.
I want to talk about confidential settlements in a moment.
But I can also go back to the subject matter of the workshops, and I'm just pointing out, since you raised the subject, Shu, that we wanted to take a look in two of these workshops at the relationship between foreclosure and some of the most vulnerable populations in associations. And one of the things I should emphasize for your listeners is that California has more associations than any other state. About a quarter of the state lives in a common interest development in California. So we are talking about 9 million people or so. It's a very large number. Homeowner associations have a huge impact on the life of Californians, and this is one of the reasons that we founded the center. And I should mention, when I say we, I mean some of the attorneys who convened these workshops were co-founders with me of this center.
I'm so impressed with what you guys are doing over there. I really and truly am. I wish we could clone you and put you in about every state there is.
Well, we can.
You can.
Well, it is possible to do. It is possible to do.
When did you found the center?
In 2005.
So it's 5 years old this
well,
year.
Yeah, yes. And that was when we incorporated. But, of course, I had been doing this work since 2001. In collaboration with other housing advocates, consumer advocates, senior advocates.
Mm-hmm.
So founding the center was a natural evolution out of that work.
Was the next step up, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
One of the things, I mean, you said that the vulnerable people within our society seem to be targeted most often for discrimination in fair housing issues, and that's precisely what I was told, and I mean what I could observe myself just doing what I do and talking to different people, that the people who either they're foreigners, they're elderly, they're afraid, they're sick, they're not very secure, and these are the people that get targeted, they get abused, they get bullied, they are taken advantage of. And there's, other than groups like yours and a few others throughout the states, there really is nothing in place to protect them. Except for the fair housing laws, and then you end up with a lot of states don't have private fair housing agencies. They're all government. I personally think there's a conflict of interest there. Listen, you know, Fairfax County has a mandate. That's where I live. Over 1 million people. Fairfax County mandates associations. We have in excess of 90% of all housing is in an association in Fairfax. That's a huge percentage. And then you add to that the fact that the Fairfax County Human Rights Commission is a member of, is an agency of the Fairfax County government, they're not going to find that these associations are a bad deal for the consumers, are they?
Well, the situation in California is different, so I can't really speak to the situation where you are, Shu, but when people call us with a fair, what turns out to be a fair housing issue, and we try to recommend that they contact a local fair housing group. And one of the reasons for that, of course, is that a nonprofit organization is in the community and has a better sense of what's going on in the community. And a fair housing organization can also be, can provide ongoing support to the homeowner filing the complaint. Whereas if you're dealing with a larger state bureaucracy, then it becomes more difficult to get personal attention and ongoing support. And I will mention, by the way, a couple things about what I just said. Often people call in here and they don't know they have a fair housing issue.
Yeah, yeah.
That this is very common.
Yeah, I get a lot of calls too, and it's sort of a process of elimination to figure out whether that's an option for them.
Well, I'll give a good example of that. We've had several cases, and there's also a very good one in Arizona, where a senior calls in fact, it may not even be the senior homeowner themselves. It may be an advocate or a grown child saying that the senior needs in-home support.
Right.
And that the association has made up this rule. Mm-hmm. Again, we come back to the rulemaking authority. Rule that the caregiver cannot live under the same roof with the senior who needs help.
Right.
So when the homeowner calls in, they are focused on the rule part.
Right.
And not on the fair housing. They don't have a word for the fair housing or a concept for the fair housing violation. So one of the things we do is, you know, vet the issue, talk it through, and identify what the issues really are. And then move forward from there. We have had several cases like that, and I think it sounds like you are familiar with the one in Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we have an almost identical one here in California now ongoing, and we have put that person in touch with the local fair housing agency. But these are not isolated cases. I mean, I think there's a lot of cases out there we don't know about. And then there are the cases that have come in here. And one of the things we do is we broker the service, and then we also provide the ongoing support with the Fair Housing Agency.
So you do actually work with the Fair Housing Agency?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, because often, and this comes back to the issue of education, which is why we are doing these workshops. Among the people that attended our workshops were the staff from fair housing agencies.
Oh, because, really?
Oh, yeah, because they want to know more about how this works and what they are dealing with. One of the things that often happens, and this will not be a surprise to you, is that the fair housing agency will, after the claim is filed, they will get in touch with the homeowner association. Well, think about who they wind up talking to.
Right.
They wind up talking to the property manager. And the property manager may, in fact, be the culprit.
Uh-huh.
So the property manager is very concerned about protecting themselves. They don't want to get sued. They don't want claims filed against them as well. So the fair housing staff is not dealing with the right person or persons, which should be the board officers. And a lot of times the board officers have no idea what the business practices of the property manager are.
Half the time they don't know what the laws are either.
Well, that's what I mean. They don't know the law. They don't realize they may be putting the association in legal jeopardy. They don't know the business practices of the property manager, and they don't know what the property manager has done in this particular instance. So, you know, among the many things we talked about in the workshops, was the fact that the fair housing staff must be in touch with the board and not a third party. Because if a claim gets filed, it's going to get filed against the homeowner association and maybe secondarily against the property manager. But it's the homeowner association, the corporation, that's going to be on the hook.
Sometimes you have situations, and I'm sure you've run into it as well, where nobody seems to know who the board members are. They don't want to be identified.
Oh, this is very common. And we urge people who come to our website is, first of all, I mean, this just seems so self-evident, but it isn't, that every homeowner needs to know who is on their board and who the officers are.
The officers don't want anyone to know who they are. They will do it as long as they're covered by anonymity.
Well, I understand the practice, but the reality is if they get sued, the suit might be filed against the property manager as well, but it's the board directors who are going to be on the firing line.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
Now, one of the other things I can mention about these workshops is that we did spend time talking about the new laws in California that allow homeowners to take certain specific issues into small claims court. And I don't know if we have talked about this on a previous program or not, Sue.
I don't know, but we can talk about it again. But before we do, I would like to reintroduce you, Marjorie. We are talking to Marjorie Murray, who is the founder and president of the California Center for Homeowners Association Law. And you've got a fabulous website, and I'm going to ask you to give us the URL in a minute. But I noticed that the core purpose of the center is to protect the rights of the homeowners through consumer education, training, and referral services, and it sounds like you are doing all of that and you're doing a bang-up job on it. Would you give us the URL, the address, so that people can find you online?
Absolutely, and we'd love to have people come and visit our website and also send us questions. It's www.calhomelaw.org. So I will also spell it, Sue. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
It's www.calhomelaw, that's all one word, .org, calhomelaw.org.
I would highly recommend that you check it out. It is a phenomenal website.
And we do have many visitors from other states. We're very glad about that. A number of the advocates from Texas, whose names are very familiar to you, Shu, visit our website regularly.
Oh, I know. I know. I hear from people. And I hear from people how much they enjoy the website. So,
great. I'm glad to hear that.
It's a great service that you're providing not only to people in California, but also to the rest of us in the rest of the country.
And one of the things I would like to say about the website is that it is not a blog. It is not opinion. We focus very much on legislation that is moving through the California legislature, on past consumer protection laws that have been put in place in California, on procedures for filing a suit in small claims court. There's a lot of workshop content on the website. Some PowerPoint information is also there. We have a whole list of issues. We have appeals court cases. There are many, many California court cases there, as well as interesting appellate cases from other states. For example, the Twin Rivers case is on the website. So I know our emphasis really is on presenting facts, evidence, and information that people can put to practical use.
I think that's great, and I think that there's a lot of really helpful information there. It's a great site, guys. You need to really check it out. And again, it's calhomelaw.org. Go there. I love the puppies.
Oh, thank you.
It seems so fresh and spring-like on there because right now we're sort of buried in snow over here in Virginia. It's been very, very cold.
Well, it's poppies and lupin. I'm a native Californian, so it was important to me to set up a website that was very Californian, so to speak. And one of the other features of the website is that there are many photographs of California courthouses on the website. Again, that's my California bias. We want to convey with the website the important idea that we are focusing on the law.
And speaking of which, you were going to talk a little bit about going to court, and I also, towards the end of this, I would like to talk a little bit about confidential agreements and settlements. So I'm going to turn it over to you. Let you have it.
Okay. Well, I will start out by saying that in the past few years, well, that means since 2004, the legislature and two different governors have seen fit to sign into law the provision that certain association disputes can be taken into small claims court. And the reason for that is what you mentioned very early on in this program, and that is that it's very difficult for homeowners to find a consumer attorney, and that if a consumer attorney can be found, they don't necessarily know this area of the law. So one of the tools that the legislature has created, and they created it because of their realization that there were a lot of disputes developing in homeowner associations and that some of them were suitable for small claims. Now, one of those dispute areas, and I can just use this one area to illustrate how this works, one dispute area is the homeowner's right to inspect and to copy association records, financial records in particular. This has been a long-standing right under the California Corporations Code. So the section from the Corporations Code was actually duplicated in the Civil Code, and so just basically carried over into the Civil Code governing associations, and recourse was created. That is, if the association denied the homeowner the right to inspect and copy records, then the homeowner could take that issue into small claims court and ask the court to basically make the association open up the records. Now, this became a small acorn that turned into a mighty oak. What I mean is that the ink was barely dry on this law when seniors from Leisure World, which is down in Orange County in Southern California, filed immediately in small claims because they had been trying to find out how their association had been spending their money. Now, this is a multi-million dollar association. It's huge. It's a senior association. They collect millions of dollars. They have millions in the reserve accounts, and the seniors couldn't find out how the money was being spent. So the association dug in its heels, refused to grant access. Seniors filed multiple suits. The association then turned around and filed a slap suit against the seniors. But they soldiered on. The suit was heard in Superior Court. The seniors won every step of the way. They won every small claim suit. They won in Superior Court. And then finally, the association took it into the appeals court, which actually turned out to be very beneficial, because at that point, it was actually when the slap suit was filed, they were represented by pro bono counsel, who also represented them in the appeals court case. And the appellate district ruled, and this became a published opinion, that the homeowner association was in the wrong and that it was going to have to open up the records, and so the seniors finally got access to it, to them. I will say, however, that this was not a short campaign. It began in 2004 and it didn't end until 2008. So it was a 4.5-year campaign. It's exhausting. And that is one of the things I will emphasize about seniors and the disabled who live in homeowner associations, and why it is so important for them to have advocates, because to bring a suit or even to bring a claim of any kind, like through a fair housing agency, that is an exhausting occupation. And it does become an occupation.
Yeah, it does.
So the seniors down in Leisure World were fortunate in that they had excellent support down there among the local small claims division, and also later they were able to get pro bono help and then excellent representation for the appeals court case. But the point I will emphasize is that this did start out as a small claims court case. And so that has been created in California as one of the potential avenues. It's not the only one, but it's one of the potential avenues.
Talking about the financial books and records, I think it's important to know what's going on. And that's going to lead me to the confidential settlement agreements. But just on the way there, look at the economic disaster that homeowner associations find themselves in now because of all the foreclosures and the lack of income, the lack of resources, especially where you have services that are bundled, like, you know, internet and cable television. I mean, not everybody wants that, and not everybody needs to pay for it, but the association set up so that it's, you know, so that people have to pay for it. But anyway, these are things that people need to know. Maybe you can get them changed down the road and say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we don't really need this. We don't watch TV. We don't have a computer. We don't want to have to pay for this. So it's important to see where your money's going and how it's being spent. And that's on an everyday basis. But one of my big bugaboos, Marjorie, is the confidential settlements.
Well, could I speak for a moment to the first thing you said, Sue, which is the problem that because of the foreclosures and homeowners' inability to pay assessments, associations are doing some extraordinary things here in California. I don't know if it's taking place in other states. You would be in a better position to speak to that. But one of the things that's happening is associations are changing the CC&Rs to make homeowners responsible for the exclusive use common areas. And by that I mean, you know, the common areas, it might be a backyard, it might be an easement, it might be some other feature which is actually the property of the homeowner association.
Right.
But is now being assigned to the individual homeowner for care and maintenance.
Mm-hmm. That's in condominiums, right?
No. No, I'm not talking about condominiums. I'm talking about planned unit developments, which are single-family homes. And I should mention, because California, again, may be different from other states, like Virginia, local governments in California often require that that the developer create the common interest development if he wants to get a permit.
Mm-hmm.
But these are not necessarily condominiums or even townhomes. These are huge subdivisions of comprising single-family homes. And so we are talking now, when I'm describing the homeowner's responsibility for exclusive use common areas, it's in these subdivisions.
Wow.
So this is a huge financial burden, of course, that the homeowners are being forced to take on. And again, this comes back to the rulemaking and legislative authority, if you will, of the homeowner association to make homeowners do this.
Wow. I had not. I knew that it was happening in condominiums, which is where you typically find the exclusive use common areas, because in an HOA, typically you own the land and you don't really have exclusive use to any of the common areas. They're common to all.
Well, these are exclusive use common areas that are contiguous with the property. But in the past, the association was responsible for upkeep and maintenance, and now the individual homeowner is under amended CC&Rs. And of course, in California, amended CC&Rs are supposed to be voted on by the homeowners, but that important step does not take place.
I'm hearing that more and more and more, that you know, the association is just amending the governing documents. The homeowners don't know that it's their right to vote on it.
Right.
It's just an absolute disaster. And, of course, CAI is out there. They're trying to give, if you do, and I can't say this often enough, but there's a bill that was introduced in Virginia last year, twice actually, mm-hmm. and didn't pass, but I understand that CAI is going to be shopping this around to all the states, and it probably will not be found in the HOA laws. But what they want to do is, if an HOA decides, a board decides that they need to change the governing documents because mm-hmm. they need extra powers they don't have, and they try for three times, they don't even actually have to hold the election, but they have to try three times to vote on these changes.
Mm-hmm.
And if the homeowners fail to approve these changes, the board can go to court and get judicial reformation. So in other words, a judge can say, oh yes, board, we agree with you. You know, the homeowners would be much better off if you had more powers over them. So there you go, we're going to change the governing documents.
Well, that's already the case in in California, where associations, I don't know how frequently they do this, they do it from time to time, they go into superior court and get the quorum requirement reduced so that they can change the governing documents with less effort.
Isn't that illegal? Well, we're not attorneys, but it would seem to me that's interference with contract.
Well,
I mean, this is the contract that CAI, you know, bows and scrapes to?
Well, I guess we might have to save that for another conversation.
I think we will,
yeah,
because that's going to be a long one. But I do want to touch on a little bit the confidential settlements, and I'm going to take Karen's case just for an example, because mm-hmm. you used that before. You said that there was a settlement and it was mm-hmm. confidential, which means that either the association had to give Karen, her attorney, or whoever, a sum of money. And this is money that belonged to the other members of the association. Or the insurance company kicked in and paid the claim and then raised the premium, which still means that the other members of the association are going to have to cover. And
yes, I think those are the two possibilities, and I think this is a very I'm not even sure what word to use, but this makes it very difficult to assess the outcome. I mean, because we don't know what the financial consequences were to the other homeowners.
But don't you think the other homeowners should know that their money was used instead of plowing the streets or repairing the sidewalk or whatever, that the money was used to cover the faux pas of the board and possibly the association attorney who advised them, the management company? See, my thing is, and I got this idea when I interviewed Marion Rosen following the Winona Blevins thing. Marion said that in Texas there was a law, and nobody seems to be able to figure out what that law was or where it came from, but that if you're a not-for-profit organization, mm-hmm. you cannot enter into a confidential settlement agreement, mm-hmm. which to me makes a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree?
That's a very interesting point, because there was legislation passed only last year in California that if there is a, I think it was an ADA claim, Americans with Disability Act claim, submitted to the court, that it had to remain confidential. Well, you know, the movement of the California legislature has actually been towards more transparency, not less. And that's one of the reasons that these laws allowing for small claim suits over the transparency of records, that there was not only one bill, but there were two signed into law on this very issue. So, yeah, I mean, I think that that would be a very good idea to ensure that this cloak of, you know, secrecy be removed. I mean, why should they be able to enter into these confidentiality agreements? And, of course, the reason they want to hide them is they don't want to be inspiring other people to take legal action against the association.
Not only that, but they don't want people to know what's happening with the money.
Well, and they don't want to know how much the attorneys are charging.
That's true. That plus they're paying for the other person's attorneys, plus they're settling for the other person. If it's your, they're using your money to do that, and in most cases they have the ability to come in and raise the assessments, whether they, you know, it's a, there's a cap on it by statute, 5%, 10%, whatever it is, and I think there is a cap in California. In my governing documents, it's tied to the CPI, but most places don't have that cap. They don't have that safety net. So associations are able to raise, or, you know, the boards are able to raise the assessments and charge special assessments,
right,
with, you know, with gay abandon. And the homeowners can lose their homes. I think the homeowners need to know why they need that money or where that money's going, and exactly what it is that their boards have cost them.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. To try to get that in place through legislation is, well, would be a challenge, let's put it that way. How's that?
Very diplomatic. Extremely diplomatic, Marjorie.
Yes, would be a challenge.
But I think it's a no-brainer. As far as I'm concerned, it's a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, I think that associations need, or homeowners need to know where their money's going.
Well, that's the basis for these two bills signed into law, that it's like putting your money in the bank. You expect the bank to send you on a monthly basis how much money, how much interest it has accrued, and where it's gone, and what the bank fees are. And if you have a question or a dispute about the bank's record keeping, then you have every right to go to the bank and inspect and copy the records.
So why is it so different for a homeowners association?
Well, you tell me.
So why is it that if the legislature can say banks, you've got to provide them with this information, and also other investment companies? I mean, you've got to send them a list to show them exactly what you're doing to protect their investment. Why shouldn't HOAs be required to do the same? They claim that they protect property values. Show us what you've done to protect property values. You've entered into confidential agreements. Why? Did you have the right to do what you were doing, or were you acting outside the authority you had? And why am I going to pay for your stupidity?
Well, I think what it says is that we have a ways to go before we have true transparency, particularly in the area of financial records and where the money is going and where it's being siphoned off and so forth.
But anyway, that's my bugaboo. That's my soapbox. It's one of my big things right now. But we've got about 2 minutes left, Marjorie. What's in store? What have you got on the horizon?
Well, we are going to continue to do these workshops this coming year. So we will be reaching out to more homeowners and to more attorneys to interest them in this subject area, or to deepen their knowledge of this subject area of the law. And I think our workshops this year, the previous year, have whetted the appetite of quite a few people. So we have had many requests to continue the training, and that is our intention. We also expect to expand our training via our website, because I think the demand is, the hunger, really, for good information is so great that the best way to share it is through our website and through our web training.
Do you get a lot of calls from people looking for help?
If I had 10 phones, they would be ringing nonstop, yes. So we get calls for help. And not only by phone, but also by email. We probably get 15 emails a day and half that many phone calls.
Those are the isolated incidents that we hear about?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean. Oh, I see. You're pulling my leg here. Yeah, right, the isolated incidents.
Because
right.
We hear all the time, oh, no, you know, everything is operating so smoothly and beautifully. Mm-hmm. Those are just a few isolated incidents. And so the isolated incidents have been keeping you very busy. Marjorie, thank you. I'm going to let you get back to some more of your isolated incidents, because I know they're hanging up there waiting to talk to you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much, Sue. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And thanks for taking the time out to join us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Anytime.
Marjorie Murray from the
the Center for California Homeowner Association Law.
I knew there was another C in there someplace.
Well, it is a bit of a mouthful, but it does say in a very straightforward way what we do.
Exactly what you do, and that's the important thing. So thank you.
You're very welcome, Sue.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us today. Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO.
Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.